In America, the cause for life will ultimately be won with science, facts, and persuasion. Attempting to merely tether our rights to interior notions is not enough for law and public policy. Rights of conscience are vital, but living in our communities where our core truths are accepted and defended is vital, especially concerning the human right to life. These tasks are urgently necessary. Today, we're excited to speak with Ryan Anderson, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., John Paul II teaching fellow at the University of Dallas and founding editor of Public Discourse. Ryan received his bachelor's from Princeton University and his PhD in political philosophy from the University of Notre Dame. Before his recent appointment as president of the EPPC, Ryan was the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Ryan's a prolific writer, speaker, and teacher, and we're excited to speak with him today about human dignity, human rights, and religious liberty. I am Tom Shakley, and this is Life, Liberty, and Law. Welcome to Life, Liberty, and Law. I am Tom Shakley. This is brought to you by Americans United for Life, where we advance the human right to life in culture, law, and policy. And we're thrilled to be joined today by Ryan Anderson from the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Ryan, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
It's so good to connect with you. And of course, we've also got Noah Brandt as well. How are you doing, Noah?
Good. I'm a fanboy, Tom. I'm a fanboy of Ryan Anderson. I love the public discourse. I love everything Ryan does. So I am pumped. I'm pumped up.
It's great stuff. Yeah, Ryan, you're coming in just as we mentioned as the incoming president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. So I guess first order is congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So this is halfway through week number two. I started on Monday, February 1st, and we're recording this Wednesday, February 10th. I'm not sure when it'll air for listeners, but just to give an idea of. You know, I'm still drinking from a fire hose in terms of getting my sea legs to mix, you know, two different metaphors there in terms of life at the top of the EPPC food chain.
Well, we're excited to be in on the ground floor as you get set here, Ryan, and we'll dive right into it. You know, you wrote a recent piece concurrent with you coming into EPPC on religious liberty. You know, these are issues that have gripped the nation for years now, but they seem to be taking on a particularly hot temperature in recent times. You write in the Wall Street Journal that religious liberty isn't enough. That was the headline of the piece. And, you know, first, I think we need to ask, I guess, what is religious liberty? We hear this so often. What is it? You know, how can we understand it? You know, how do we make sense of its context? Little Sisters of the Poor, I think, of in the news as a headline for years is a case that has that word invoked in it. But what does this mean?
Sure. I mean, I think the place to start with what is religious liberty is to kind of start by asking what is religion, right? And so in the classical tradition, religion is the virtue of what we owe to the Creator, right? So religion is kind of a subset of the cardinal virtue of justice. And so the idea here is that part of justice is rendering what is due to others. And there's something that is due to God. Right? And so religion is how we fulfill that duty to God. And this is at home. So this is, I mean, you'll find that right in the Summa. If you look kind of within Thomas's classification of the virtues, you'll see this discussion of the virtue of justice. You'll see a subset of that being the virtue of religio, or, you know, in English, religion. And this isn't just kind of at home within the classical and Catholic tradition. You'll see this in the American tradition. So when, you know, it's slightly different because Madison puts this in kind of like social compact language rather than classical virtue theory. But he says that when he gives in the Memorial and Remonstrance, you know, his defense of religious liberty, he talks about the duties that we owe to the Creator and the manner of discharging them, like a vertical relationship between creature and creator. And then he says, because of that relationship, the vertical relationship between creature and creator, it then creates a horizontal relationship of creatures with respect to each other, and therefore creatures with respect to political authority, and that's one of liberty, that vis-a-vis each other, we stand in a relationship of liberty or of right, something like that, precisely so that we have the space to fulfill our duties to God. And so if you think about religious liberty It's not morally neutral, right? So it's not kind of a libertarian liberty in that sense. It's precisely kind of a perfectionistic liberty, meaning that within the kind of like perfectionism, anti-perfectionism debate within political philosophy, it's for the sake of a good, right? Perfectionism, that it's for the sake of perfecting our nature, perfecting our created nature, that we need to have certain space to live out our religious lives, right? And the Little Sisters of the Poor need that space. Orthodox Jewish synagogues need that space. And you know, just earlier this week, they got a big victory against Governor Cuomo. And so within the kind of American political and legal tradition, it's not a theologically adjudicated liberty, right? So it's not a liberty just for people who are, you know, theologically orthodox, right? So it's going to apply to like Catholics and Protestants and Jews and Muslims and Mormons, that provided you don't violate justice or the political common good. So you can't be engaged in like child sacrifice or homicide or, you know, right? There's not going to be a theological test for orthodoxy. That in a pluralistic country like America, the idea here is that the Orthodox Jew needs to be accountable to God for his or her religious beliefs and needs the space to fulfill those duties as they understand it. Same thing for the Roman Catholic nun, same thing for the evangelical baker, right? And, you know, I picked those three examples because all three of them have recently been in courts saying that the secular government was infringing their religious liberty rights by denying them legitimate liberty, legitimate space to fulfill their religious duties as they understand it. Right? And that's important because in America, we disagree about religious duties. And the Orthodox Jew and the evangelical baker and the Roman Catholic nun, they might agree about lots of things. In fact, I mean, I think they probably agree about the vast majority of things. But where they disagree about things, they need the space to answer those questions and to live out their religious commitments where they're accountable to God and not to Uncle Sam. Right. So that's the basic idea of kind of like, what is religious liberty? I think you really have to go back to what is religion to really answer that well.
I mean, right, Ryan, that sounds great. You know, I mean, you're speaking my language. Years ago, you know, I was an intern at the Heritage Foundation, this religious liberty. what we're told and what I believe is religious liberty rocks. You know, religious liberty rocks my socks. It's foundational. Can't get enough. Put it through my veins. I mean, my goodness, Ryan Anderson, you're controversial. Why is religious liberty not enough? Don't we need more religious liberty? And then maybe one day that'll be enough?
All right, so yes, we do need more religious liberty. I mean, so religious liberty is important and it's essential, but it's not enough because there are other things that are important and essential as well. And so to say that religious liberty isn't enough is not in any way to knock religious liberty. It's not in any way to criticize like the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty or Alliance Defending Freedom, right? There are First Liberty Institute. There are lots of really good kind of like religious liberty focused public interest law firms that do heroic work, right? One of those victories that I mentioned earlier was a Beckett victory. And you know, I think just yesterday they announced they're suing the city of Chicago for interfering with the Catholic Church's ability to pick a priest, right? So it's essential, but it's not enough because there are other things that matter and there are other things that are essential that aren't merely religious liberty disputes. And so in the Wall Street Journal op-ed, I mentioned a couple, and since this is, you know, an AUL podcast, let's just start with life. The right to life and the dignity of life and the child in the womb's survival is not primarily a religious liberty issue, right? Whether or not that baby will one day be religious, whether or not that mother is or is not religious, whether or not that abortionist is or is not religious, is all besides the point to a certain extent, right? I mean, like the primary thing that, we're not just concerned with like, well, I don't want to be complicit in abortion. Look, that's important, right? I don't think the owners of Hobby Lobby should have to pay for abortion-causing drugs and devices. I don't think as a taxpayer, I should have to pay for abortion. But the reason why, right, to go a step deeper is precisely because I think abortion is unjust, right? Abortion is the unjust taking of a human life that has dignity, that has worth. If you want to use rights language, that has a right to life. And so that's what we also have to be concerned about. So religious liberty is important, but it's not enough. Because if we lived in a country that said, okay, we respect religious liberty for pro-lifers, but we still have abortion on demand throughout all 40 weeks of pregnancy, none of us should be happy with that outcome, right? That's not good enough, because what we're concerned about here is not just the owners of Hobby Lobby not having to pay for it, not just the Little Sisters of the Poor not being complicit in it, but also protecting the babies in the womb, right? And so I think this is like, for you know, listeners of this podcast, this should be an obvious example. And then we can turn it to other things, right? Turn it to marriage issues, turn it to transgender issues that might be a little bit more controversial, because I think so many people after Obergefell got very defensive, and they're like, all right, we just have to defend religious liberty. We just have to defend, and it's like, all right, we do have to defend religious liberty, but we shouldn't give up on underlying truth claims about human nature, human embodiment as male and female. And the last thing I'll say just on this question, because I know, you know, there are other things we want to chat about, is just that I think if you are pro-life in particular, you need to care about human sexuality and marriage. Because even if we overturn Roe, and even if, you know, we pass good abortion law, I don't even think that will be enough. So long as we have a misguided understanding of our sexuality, and so long as we have unplanned pregnancies outside of marriage, a certain percentage of the population, even if it's illegal, will have recourse to abortion, right? And so I think part of what we need to do as like a long-term pro-life strategy is actually like respond to the sexual revolution where sex just became a contact sport, and, you know, do whatever we can to kind of like build up a sound understanding of our embodiment, a sound understanding of the purpose of our sexuality, and a sound embodiment of marriage. I think marriage is probably the long-term best protector of the dignity and the worth of the child in the womb. And partly because, I mean, like, if you just think of this, you know, what do we owe to children? It's not just that we owe to them that they won't be killed in the womb, but we also owe to them the best chance possible that they will be raised by their married mother and father, right? And if you look at this from the child's perspective, what's in that child's best interest? It's not just to not be aborted, but it's also, whenever possible, to be conceived into a loving family between a mother and a father, where that mother and father are committed to each other and then committed to raising that child. And that needs to be the ultimate long-term goal, I think, of all pro-lifers. And it might be controversial within certain quarters, but I just think as you know, a rock bottom, like bedrock principle, like that's what we're ultimately concerned about here.
It makes so much sense, right, Ryan? All of these things are integrated, they're integral to one another, and you know, you can't solve one without the other. And so whether you want to look at sort of traditional problems, right, of, you know, you think of like a play like Annie, right, where the problems of yesterday might have been something like too many children in an orphanage. You know, the problems today are in certain parts of the world, no children to adopt, or in other parts of the world, you know, the burgeoning issue of surrogacy, right? And the rights and crimes that often occur with that as people may be manipulated, or as human beings are, you know, in practice, if not particularly legally, specifically narrowly legally, bought and sold. So many issues that relate to that. And you look at you're right, the family, even before this century, and things were simpler in that sense, where you had subsidiarity more in practice, right? And so communities and families were the first responders for both for good and for ill, right? You know, if bad things happened, families and communities could respond to that at the local level. Whereas today, you know, we've all seen the dramas and crises of recent times of this, as the celebrity culture is kind of just, you know, soaked into so much of our culture, and everything's become nationalized in a really negative way. But as we talk about, you know, some of these issues, Ryan, of course, you know, I think of as religious liberty not being enough, as you spoke to that, the reasons why, you know, think of the case from a year or two ago, right, when the Satanic Temple was coming out and saying, well, actually, you know, we want religious liberty to exempt ourselves from abortion laws, you know, in states that prohibit abortion because they recognize it's a human person. So I think that's probably an example, right, of this reason why we can't just narrowly say it's a religious liberty exemption from sort of like a rational approach to an issue. It's got to be deeper.
Yeah, and I mean, a couple of things to say there. The first is that one of the reasons why, you know, when you had asked me about, you know, what is religious liberty, you know, I mentioned that both within the classical tradition and for the American founders, that it's centered upon God and the duties that we owe to God. is precisely to kind of like, you know, anticipate the question about like, what about the satanic temple or something like that? They are making a mockery of religion, right? This is not an authentic, sincere, you know, search for the ultimate cause of the universe, the prime mover, the uncaused cause, right? This is not a sincere search for the creator and the duties that we owe to the creator in Madison's language. And so that's one reason to be skeptical of the satanic temple. The second thing to be concerned about when, you know, they're trying to get out of an abortion regulation, for example, is that all of our liberties have limits, right? None of our liberties are absolute and unlimited. This is true for, you know, economic liberties. It's also true for religious liberties. And so no one's going to say that the Aztec has a religious liberty right for human sacrifice. And we shouldn't say that, you know, even if you think the satanic temple is engaged in religion, that doesn't justify human sacrifice. And whether that's Aztec sacrifice or unborn baby sacrifice, that the religious liberty, you know, when the Second Vatican Council talks about it, for the Catholics who are listening, it talks about the requirements of justice and the common good. The American legal tradition talks about compelling government interests that are being pursued in the least restrictive way possible. And obviously, like, protecting innocent human life from lethal violence is a compelling government interest. And the least restrictive way possible of doing that, the way to think about this is, like, what is wrong with lethal violence? Is it that too much lethal violence is a problem? The way that, you know, maybe you could say that certain pollution is a problem, and so you have, like, car emissions regulations, but then you can exempt, you know, antique cars that don't have modern emissions stuff, right? Because too much emissions is a problem, but we can exempt the antique cars. You know, too much homicide.
Antique cars look cool, so you got to exempt them.
You know, and the same thing's true. Too much homicide is a problem, but we can exempt the satanic temple. Like, no, any homicide's a problem. And so the least restrictive way possible here is going to be an absolute ban on homicide, right? So that's how you would think about, to my mind, what is a spurious claim to religious liberty. And they do this to make a mockery of religion, and they do it to try to undermine the value of religious liberty, right? And so I think, you know, that's how you can respond to someone who asks, you know, what about the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, or the Church of the Satanic Temple? One, it's not sincere religion, and two, even if it were, there are limits to our liberties, and obviously killing would be one of those limits.
That's right. Yeah, you think about rights of conscience, right? And part of the, you know, just the basic smell test for these things is how sincere is the claimed conscience issue. And, you know, what you've got, you know, I think years ago when people, there was some movement of like people trying to register as Jedi, either for their religion or their political party or something like that. That's not, I mean, it's funny, I guess, for them, but it's not sincere. So when, you know, these things come to a court of law, you know, that's how they have to be looked at, is, you know, you can't just say, well, they say that they're a part of the Church of Satan and that child sacrifice is a key part of their tenets. And you say, this is all made up.
Right. And just like what the litigators tell me is that this is almost never the sticking point for the litigation on this stuff, that the courts know how to kind of like tease out legitimate claims versus illegitimate claims. That the Obama administration, you know, with the Little Sisters of the Poor and Hobby Lobby, they just conceded that the Green family and the Little Sisters were sincere about their objections. They just claimed, I mean, the argument that they made was that this was a compelling government interest and this was the least restrictive way possible of doing it. And they made the claim in the Hobby Lobby case that, you know, a for-profit business can't even exercise religion. So they're like, yeah, their religious beliefs are sincere, but once you go into business, you have to leave your sincere religious beliefs behind, right? So it's also kind of just worth pointing out for listeners that, like, this tends not to be the sticking point for the litigation on this stuff. It tends to be much more, you know, the government claiming that you don't get to exercise religion if you're running a business, or the government claiming, you know, cost-free coverage of abortifacients is a compelling interest and the only way we can do it is to coerce the nuns, right? I mean, which are just, you know, these are ludicrous claims, which is why the Little Sisters have won three different times at the Supreme Court. And they're likely to have to go back to the Supreme Court with the new administration, right? Which is, again, just like a terrible commentary on the state of America. But there we are.
Yeah, that's incredible, right? Noah, as I hear this, I think of, like, it seems much more insidious to actually to do that game, right, where you say, well, we think that you really do believe this, that it is really important, that it's central to you, but we don't care. We're going to coerce you nonetheless. I mean, that's sort of like a next level approach to it. And I guess it gets into this issue of, you know, these issues of human dignity and human rights. we call many things human rights. There's constant debates about this. You know, you had the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, still within living memory, about 70 years ago, after World War II. And since then, there's a whole kind of complex that's been created globally through NGOs and through the United Nations and domestically here, where it's like, it seems as if now...
The terrifying industrial human rights complex. You know?
In some ways, right? Because it seems as if, you know, when you get to the point where folks are standing up and saying, you know, if they're a member of the Church of Satan, they want a right to abortion based upon their... You know, when we get to that point where human rights are being used as a cudgel for these things, Ryan, who decides what a human right is? How do we adjudicate these claims?
Yeah, I mean, so ultimately, who decides? We all have to decide, right? I mean, there isn't kind of a central authority on human rights that we can defer to. And the way that we have to decide is, you know, by thinking philosophically and theologically about this. You would ask, you know, where does human dignity kind of come from? What's the foundation there? Look, it comes from our nature, theologically, as created in the image and likeness of God, right? That's going to be, the Imago Dei is going to be the foundation, the bedrock of where human dignity and human worth comes from in kind of a theological guise. It comes from God, right? It comes from God as the creator, and it comes from God creating us in his very image and likeness. Philosophically, you can think about this in terms of, you know, human beings having reason and will and freedom and therefore self authorship. I like that phrase better than the Lockean self ownership. But the idea that, like, we bear a responsibility for shaping our lives and we do so reasonably, and that, you know, there's a intersection here between the philosophical and the theological. Like, when we say we're made in the image and likeness of God, you know, that doesn't mean that God, has two legs and two arms and 10 fingers, 10 toes. No, I mean, like, God's nature is a communion of persons in love, right? And love is, you know, a relationship of reason and will, where you will the other's good for the other's sake. And, like, that's human nature as well. Like, we imitate, we're an analogy right there. And so that's going to be the foundation, you know, philosophically, theologically, of where human dignity comes from. And then the question becomes, you know, what are the ways in which human nature is perfected? You know, what's human flourishing look like? What are the human goods? Friendship, marriage, knowledge, union with God, you know, the kingdom of God, right? What is Jesus always talking about? He's talking about the kingdom, right? And what's going on at the kingdom? It's like a wedding feast, right? There's going to be a fulfillment of, you know, friendship and solidarity and community and you know, a face-to-face vision of God, right? And so then the question becomes, for human rights, all right, well, what are the rights that protect human flourishing? I mean, this is the way I don't think the Lockean approach to natural rights is philosophically sound. I don't think Kantian approaches to this. I mean, I think the way that you're going to think about this in a philosophically and theologically sound way is going to be more out of the Aristotelian Thomistic tradition, which historically didn't use rights language. There's a debate about this, you know, into how much of a theory of natural rights you can kind of tease out of Aquinas, because the virtue of justice talks about what is due to another person. And so, that word can be translated into right singular. And then there's a question of whether or not it could also be rights plural. But the basic idea here is that it's like two sides of the same coin, that if the virtue of justice is about what I owe to someone else, well, then what that thing that is owed to someone else could be said to be that person's right. And so John Paul II had no problem using rights talk in a way very different than how 21st century liberals talk about rights. I think what he was trying to do there was actually, you know, think about all throughout Christian history, you have enculturation, you have, you know, Christians baptizing and transforming, you know, pagan practices and pre-Christian practices, you know, baptizing and transforming them. And I think he was trying to do something similar with rights talk. I think it's an open debate as to whether or not that project can be successful. There's a really good book that just came out from an Anglican theologian and philosopher titled The Problem with Rights. Why am I blanking on his name right now? It'll come to me in a minute. I was reading it over the Christmas holiday. But, like, I think that's a debate worth having. And so But the basic point here is that whether or not we use the language of rights, human rights, natural rights, if they exist, and to the extent that they exist, they're founded in natural law, which is founded in human nature, which derives kind of its dignity and worth from being made in the image and likeness of God in the theological context, and, you know, having reason and free will in the philosophical context, which means that to adjudicate these debates, we can't just appeal to rights. We actually are going to have to appeal to, you know, what does human flourishing look like? What does human nature look like? And how is this purported right claim advancing human flourishing and protecting human nature, or undermining human flourishing and debasing human nature? That's bedrock. And I think that's where more of the conversation should be conducted.
Ryan, you know, I think there's a tension among sort of people with a more classical view or conservative view when it comes to these, whatever we want to call them, if we want to call them rights that we all possess that we don't want violated, and what the government's role is, because we want to view the government as sort of a guarantor of these rights, make sure they're not violated. But I think there's also a tension to where another group who might think similarly wants the government to take a light hand in what those rights are, because if they declare the wrong things are rights, right, maybe if you can't think certain things or can't do certain things, then you're in trouble. Because then the government that's supposed to guarantee your right to something is going to guarantee more or less that you can't do it. And so some people might look at what you talk about, and it's sort of like the government declaring winners and losers, right? Like if religious liberty isn't enough, then we're kind of saying that at the end of the day, the government needs to come down on one side or the other. And that's a problem, because they might come down the wrong side. You know, it's not like we're an 80-20 nation. What we believe, we're pretty split.
Well, I mean, look, of course. I mean, it's always possible that the government could come down on the wrong side of certain questions. But that doesn't change the reality that government neutrality on many questions is impossible. And here's what I mean by that. Either we're going to allow homicide or we're not. You can't say, well, you know, I'm neutral on homicide. You know, you can't say, I mean, this is what Stephen Douglas tried to do on slavery. You know, I'm neutral on slavery. If you want to own a slave, own a slave. If you don't want to own a slave, don't own a slave. If the territories, the new territories that were going to enter the Union, if they want slaves, they can vote it up. And if they don't want slaves, they can vote it down. And what Lincoln pointed out was that to take that position on slavery and the territories is to already have taken a position on slavery. Because it's like curbside recycling. Should we have curbside recycling or should we have recycling center? Who knows? I'm neutral. Let people vote about it. Local communities.
Everything is like curbside recycling, right? Yeah.
But like slavery is not like curbside recycling. Abortion isn't like curbside recycling. And the same thing's going to be true for...
Put that on a t-shirt.
The same thing's going to be true for all of the transgender stuff, right? Either we allow high school boys who identify as girls into the girl locker rooms and into the girl sports teams, or we don't, right? There's no neutrality on that question. And so, yes, the government could come down on the wrong side. And in fact, during the Obama years, they came down on the wrong side. During the Biden years, they're coming down on the wrong side. But that doesn't mean that when, you know, our people, our representatives are in power, that they should feign the neutrality. Like, what is the neutral position on these questions? There isn't one, right? But now, all right, so here's the kind of like caveat or the limiting principle here is, while that is true on certain questions, on other questions, like the way in which the government advances the common good and protects human flourishing is by being a little bit more neutral. And what I mean by that is that when it comes to something like free speech, the way in which the government advances the cause of the truth is by not censoring based on the viewpoint of the speaker. Now, there are other things in which the government can limit speech, right? If it's incitement to violence, if it's obscenity, if it's defamation, libel, slander, right? There are all sorts of things that the government can limit speech. But it can't say we think pro-lifers have the wrong viewpoint and therefore we're going to silence you. Right. And so here, I mean, this has actually been really important for us because lots of governments have tried to censor the speech of pro-lifers, saying that you can't speak outside of a Planned Parenthood, you can't be on the sidewalk, et cetera, et cetera. And we've won important court cases protecting the freedom there precisely by saying the way in which the cause of truth is advanced, you know, given our circumstances, is by the government protecting robust debate about the truth, right? And that's different than, you know, obscenity, right? So to my mind, pornography should not be protected by the First Amendment, right? This is not what the founders were talking about when they said free speech or freedom of the press. Freedom of the press was meant to be able to advance ideas and arguments, not pornographic images or other obscene content. I think you can have obscene content that uses words, right? So, I mean, that's my point there, is that we need to be able to say when is a certain liberty advancing human dignity and human flourishing, and where is it undermining, right? So liberty for Playboy and Hustler strikes me as undermining it. But liberty for, you know, AUL to host and publish this podcast strikes me as advancing it, right? And that's, you know, there's an essay I wrote with Robbie George.
That's a very helpful viewpoint for us at this moment. So I appreciate that.
Well, but I mean, you could see in general how, regardless of what the debate is, all of us are going to be better off if we can have a robust debate. Like, who knows what the truth is about, you know, there's a debate right now between Romney and Mike Lee and Marco Rubio on the best way to do kind of child tax credit and government support for families. We need to be able to debate those things. And we can't like preemptively decide that one side has the right viewpoint, the other side has the wrong viewpoint, and then shut it down. And this is how governments throughout human history have kind of like used censorship for political agendas, right? So that's my only point there, is that simultaneously, we need to be able to say that the state is meant to protect human dignity and human flourishing. And sometimes that means protections of rights and liberties. And sometimes that means like an actual substantive policy, you know, whether that's about marriage, about life, about our identity as male or female, et cetera, et cetera. And we need both of those things. And that's where the tension is, right? And it's a necessary tension. It's an unavoidable tension. And both sides, like some try to, you know, rush to the libertarian solution of the side and just say everything should be about liberty. And some try to rush to kind of like the substantive side of the tension and say everything should be about the substance. And I actually think like the genius of America was that it was always both. And certain kind of like hagiographers of the founders who try to turn the founders and people who try to turn Ronald Reagan into a libertarian, right? They do a disservice to that tension and the way that the founders and someone like Reagan actually wrestled with the tension.
Yeah, it's important, I think, as you're mentioning, right, that the founding and the constitutional vision of the country, you know, the idea that simply because there might be a market for a particular thing doesn't mean that that in itself is a justification for it. You know, whether that market exists for slavery in certain places or whether the market exists for something like pornography, you know, right, there might be an interest in something, but the question is, does it do harm? Is it good? Does it reflect the truth? And so, you know, exactly that debate of the First Amendment, you know, it's the whole reason for it is to try to figure out, can we figure out what's true together as a democracy?
Yes. And this is how, I mean, look, the founders distinguished between liberty and license. And so this is an important question. Anytime you're talking to a libertarian, ask them if they can distinguish between liberty and license, right? And the way that the founders distinguished this was that liberty was under natural law. And license was when you abused your liberty by violating the natural law, right? I mean, so like the way in which the founders understood this was that like there is a rightful liberty, and it's to live out the moral requirements that we all have given our nature under the natural law, and license is the violation of that. And so slavery, although not all of the founders saw this, and even some who saw it, not all of them were willing to acknowledge and admit it and do what was politically necessary at the time to live in accordance with it. But you know, eventually we got there and we saw that slavery was license, not liberty. Hopefully one day we get there on abortion, that it's license, not liberty. Hopefully one day we get there on pornography, that it's license, not liberty. There's a great book by Michael Sandel, a man of the political left side of the spectrum, but he's a good critic of Rawlsian liberalism. And he wrote a book, I don't know, maybe now 10 years ago, titled What Money Can't Buy. And he was explaining that there are certain things that shouldn't be for sale, including things like sex, right? And like political office, right? And this is why we don't have markets, thank God, in pornography. And there are some people who want to, you know, say this is sex work and they want to, you know, create markets in pornography. I mean, the markets that we do have need to be eliminated. There are, you know, black markets in sex work. We shouldn't be kind of like dignifying this the way that some people at like Reason Magazine and Cato sometimes talk about this.
And the last thing we want to do when it comes to an issue like abortion, with the Hyde Amendment and with the question of government funding in, or promotion in general internationally, is to promote or expand those markets that might already, you know, be there in some form, but, you know, the government's role is not to subsidize or to promote them. All right, Ryan, something you wrote last year that stuck with me on the topic of moving past this religious liberty alone defense and toward a more substantive defense, a more public-facing witness of the type we're describing. You know, you write, "The pro-life movement, thankfully, did not make this mistake. It did not ask simply to be left alone in peace with a sincere religious belief about the sanctity of life. It demanded, you say, that Roe v. Wade be overturned and that the unborn children be protected by law. The pro-life movement," you continue, "was able to walk and chew gum at the same time, to protect people's right not to be complicit in the evil of abortion while simultaneously working to reshape both law and culture to respect and protect unborn life." Unquote. I think that's so important, right? It's such a distinguishing thing about the success of the pro-life movement over incredibly 50 years, isn't it?
I think that's, I mean, when Roe v. Wade was decided and when the first March for Life was organized, it was not at all obvious that, what is it now, 48 years later, this would be, you know, our generation would be referred to as the pro-life generation. And that Lila Rose and Kristen Hawkins and like all of these like young, dynamic pro-life women would be leading the movement. That was not at all inevitable, right? And what was required was that, you know, there were those early leaders who kind of put their hand to the plow, said this 7-2 decision, right? So we lost Roe v. Wade by a much wider margin than Obergefell was 5-4, you know, Bostock was 6-3, right? I mean, Roe v. Wade was 7-2. People thought this might be open. Like, they didn't give up. And what they did was they didn't just say, all right, well, we need to protect Catholic hospitals or something like that, although that was important. And so 6 months after, I think Roe v. Wade was January of 73, I believe it was June or July of 73, Frank Church, a Democratic senator from Idaho, introduces and then it gets passed the Church Amendment, which protects pro-life medical professionals from having to perform abortion. And the idea here was that if the court has now created a right to abortion, Congress is a check and a balance, can at least protect the right not to perform an abortion. That was important, right? That was a conscience protection, religious liberty protection, but it wasn't enough. And the pro-life movement never said it was enough, never was satisfied merely with let's protect Catholic healthcare or let's protect pro-life conscience. They said, look, that's important, but there are other things that are important, including vindicating the right to life for the child in the womb,
right?
Overturning Roe v. Wade as a constitutional matter, but then also enacting, you know, as many pro-life laws. And you know, AUL has been the brain child or the brain, not the child, I mean, the source.
Of the brain father.
I don't know what the brain mother. I mean, it's been the, you know, the organization that has created the templates for, you know, Michael New. You know, he does the number crunching and says, you know, more pro-life laws have been passed in the past decade than the previous, you know, 3.5 decades combined. Like, that's something you guys have done. And what it shows is that, like, we can walk and chew gum at the same time, that we have litigators who are litigating the conscience side of things, and we have legislators and activist groups that are getting this done at the state and local level. Some of those state and local laws will eventually be the way in which the litigators overturn Roe v. Wade, right? There will be a direct challenge the Roe and Casey regime. Roe will be overturned. And then we're going to try to get, you know, all, you know, it's going to be a state-by-state battle. Although I also think, you know, you guys had a great piece that your president, Catherine and Chad, Catherine Foster, Chad Pecknold, and then Josh Craddock. I'm blind, you know, I think of them all with first names, so I had to think for a minute, the last names in there. But, you know, they had tri-authored a piece, you know, that I was very happy to, you know, have edited and got published at Public Discourse, you know, arguing that, you know, look, we don't need to defer to the court. The court got Dred Scott wrong, and Lincoln said, all right, that applies to the parties of that court case, but I'm a co-equal branch of government as the president, the head of the executive branch, and that court ruling is binding on the parties to that ruling, but I have a duty to the Constitution to interpret it accurately, and I'm moving forward on my own kind of anti-slavery agenda. I think a pro-life president could do the same thing with respect to life. And you know, you guys have already put forward that proposal, but you called it the Lincoln proposal. I think it's a great initiative. And so I think, yes, the pro-life movement is something to emulate when it comes to other important issues on how we can both protect religious liberty and conscience and defend the underlying moral value that is just so key to human dignity and human flourishing. And AUL is really, you know, it's leading the way there, right? So you know, it's a good note to close on. Just like, thank you guys, because I think the work you're doing is just essential. It's thankless work, right? You get lots of attack from the various critics, et cetera, et cetera. But it's some of the most important work that a young person could kind of like dedicate their life to, right? I mean, this is the human rights issue of our generation. And it's great that you guys are leading the way on it.
Well, we're glad to be standing alongside you, Ryan. How can folks support the Ethics and Public Policy Center and become a part of your mission and work?
Sure. I mean, so our website's eppc.org. And you can read about us. I mean, we do lots of stuff. We, you know, George Weigel is the head of kind of like our Catholic Studies program. Mary Hassan is the head of the Catholic Women's Forum. And they just launched a new project called the Person and Identity Project, which is really, you know, it's meant to be a resource for churches and schools on how to think about the gender ideology craze that's really going through our culture right now. Ed Whalen, you know, heads up all of our court work. We just hired last week Roger Severino to kind of head up our HHS accountability project. You know, Roger,
amazing hire.
Thank you. I'm so happy. It's my first, you know, kind of hire on the job. You know, Roger and I used to work together at Heritage, and then, you know, for 4 years he was the head of the Office of Civil Rights at HHS in the Trump administration, undoing all of the bad stuff that the Obama people did. And now we know that the Biden people are going to try to undo all of the awesome stuff that Roger did. And Roger is going to be a watchdog here at EPPC for that. So you can learn more about what we're doing at eppc.org. If you want to support us, you know, there's a link where you can, you know, financially support us. Also, you can pray for us. Like, this work needs not just kind of financial backing, but also the spiritual backing. I'm on Twitter. If you want to, you know, kind of just like follow what I'm doing, it's at Ryan T. And A-N-D, so at R-Y-A-N-T-A-N-D. And yeah, this was great. I really appreciate you guys having me on, and this was a great discussion.
Well, we'll link to all this in the show notes, Ryan. And something we do every show as a close is our shot of gratitude. Just share something that we're grateful for. So Ryan, what's something you're grateful for?
Sure. So just this past weekend, my wife and I and our two little kids, we built a cattle rack for the back of our pickup truck out of 2x4s. We drove up to central Pennsylvania and we bought 3 sheep. Drove back down to where we live in Virginia.
Mind blowing.
And, you know, our daughter is only 8 months old, so she's kind of oblivious to this stuff. But our son is 2.5 and he loves the sheep.
He was carrying a sheep on his back.
There is a little lamb. So we had some earlier sheep that we got around Christmas time, and one of them gave birth to a lamb maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was Sunday morning. We were driving to Mass, and we looked out the window. We were like, wait a minute. I think there's an extra white thing in the woods. And so when we got back from Mass, like, went in there. We found it, and he just loves the little animals. And I'm really grateful for that, because I grew up in Baltimore City, and, like, livestock, even, like, domestic pets were just entirely foreign to my childhood. And, you know, we now have, like, I think 5 or 6 goats, and we now have, like, 10 sheep, and we have chickens and a dog and a cat. And it's just so wonderful to see, like, how my son is just so affectionate with the animals, and it brings him such joy, and it's made him a better big brother. Like, when we had, you know, our daughter 8 months ago, like, he knew how to be gentle with a little living creature because he had been gentle with the chicks as they grew into chickens. And so anyway, I just love watching it, because it kind of just like warms your heart when you see it, because it's just so different to what my childhood was like, and it's just so sweet to watch. So yeah, that's my gratitude for today.
That's beautiful, Ryan. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ryan. Tom, how about you? What's something you're grateful for?
You know, Noah, I don't know. I can't top Ryan's. It's incredible. He's living like the idyllic American farm lifestyle.
He has like a menagerie. He has goats. He has lambs.
It's fantastic. It's definitely a life goal. But, you know, Noah, something I'm grateful for on the political side is that, you know, people in our federalist system can choose who they want to lead them, even after they voted. And so you look at California, what's going on there. A lot of folks have been unhappy with California's governor, Newsom, and how he's responded to the crisis of the pandemic over the past year or so. And there's an effort underway to recall him, which I think is amazing. I grew up in Pennsylvania. We don't have recalls in Pennsylvania. And so, when you compare how different states are approaching the pandemic, the health crisis, and all of the subsequent crises that are coming from it, one of the more tragic issues is you're seeing a rise in suicides, even amongst children, because their psychological well-being has been so unmoored as a result of the lockdowns and the fragmentation of their communities, their daily life. They're not seeing their friends. They're not seeing their teachers. They're not getting out of the house, right? They're being locked into a screen into the Zoom life that we all know over the past year.
Horrible.
But we can't all live like that. And we've got to weigh the costs and the benefits of our approaches. And so I'm appreciative that states like California have this mechanism where the voters can decide who they want to lead them, even in times like this.
Do you think that the opposition to Governor Newsom, you think they're putting on signs yet, recall Newsom the nuisance? You think they're using that yet?
I don't know. Oh, you're suggesting this as an idea?
Yeah, yep.
Okay, it's workable. I think you could play with that.
Yeah. Do you like the idea of recalls in general? If you were designing a state from the ground up, you would keep a recall function?
I would love to see more recalls in more states.
Really? You see, I don't like them. I think that, we sort of have a mechanism called an election that allows people to recall. But I'm also sort of...
Recalls cause elections, Gotta
I
love
guess.
Them.
Yeah, I'm sort of Old Testament God in the way of if people make a mistake, if voters do, maybe they sit in that for a year or two.
That's the, H.L. Mencken approach, right? The voters know what they want and they deserve to get it good and hard.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's an interesting thing to be grateful for, Tom.
Noah, how about you? What's something you're grateful for?
Well, I'll give you something counterintuitive as well. I'm grateful for doing my taxes. This year's a complex tax year for the Brandt family since we moved from a state.
You're getting older
state.
When you use phrases like that in everyday life. Yeah,
a complex tax year.
Complaining about your tax bracket. Yeah.
But it's, here's something I'm thankful for, because I have a couple friends living in Europe and I was talking to them about it. And, taxes at the end of the year for them isn't like totally a thing because they're paying so much taxes all the time, like the income tax is coming out. And the big thing they have, too, is the value-added tax. You familiar with the VAT, Tom, the VAT tax?
Oh, yeah.
So the value-added tax, it's like the sales tax, but a lot worse to where if there's like a doodad, say Tom manufactures a pillow, he has a pillow company, at every stage of production, the raw materials, the sewing, the selling, a different tax is levied at each time. So that makes all these products way more expensive. And so a lot of times you go to Europe, you're like, oh, why are things so expensive? It's not only because, whatever, it's more expensive or people are making higher profit. It's because they have all of this taxation built in. But the key is it's hidden. You don't even realize that you're paying the tax. You just think it's a more expensive product. So I'm happy that in America, we have a more clear system. Your sales tax is put right on top. And at the end of the year, you got to spend a bunch of time trying to give the government as little money as possible. So, I think that though there's a lot of flaws, I'm glad that that we get the chance to kind of control our tax destiny here in the U.S.
Very cool.
It is cool, yeah.
All right, Ryan, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, if you enjoyed our conversation today with Ryan Anderson from the Ethics and Public Policy Center, please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to the show, rate it and leave a review. Let a friend know you've discovered life, liberty, and law. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for Ryan Anderson or for us, just email us at life@aul.org. I am Tom Shakley, and until next time, thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Law.